Ms. Alcorn?
Yes.
And Mr. Spivey?
Yes, sir.
You've heard me say all morning, you have 15, each side has 15 minutes to argue. We're going to give each of you 20 minutes to argue. And because they're cross appeals, I'm going to give you each the option of telling me how much time you'd each like to reserve for rebuttal. So, Ms. Alcorn?
And, Your Honor, we chatted about this morning,
okay,
or just a few minutes ago, that we'll both reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. All right.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. That's great. Thank you, Mrs. Spivey. All right. Well, Ms. Alcorn, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Katharina Alcorn, and I represent in this particular case Goldcrest Corp., the employer, Commerce and Industry Insurance Company, the carrier, and AIG, the third-party administrator or claim administrator. For purposes of oral argument, I'll just refer to them collectively as AIG. I think that makes things a little bit more streamlined. This case is a complicated case that is part of a complicated litigation history that's part of a complicated medical bill review framework. So I think that a little bit of factual background will put the case into context, but if I am spending too much time on a background, by all means, stop and we can get to the issue. But this particular case started in 2011 when a medical provider application was filed alleging that the provider had been underpaid and they were seeking their full bill balance for 4 contested dates of service. Around the same time, there were other medical provider applications that were also filed at the commission that proceeded through to opinions and went on through the appellate process. And then ultimately, this case became active again. But the same general facts apply to this case that apply to the prior cases that have come before this court. Essentially, the basic fact pattern is that the medical provider rendered services to an injured worker in a workers' compensation context. The bill was presented to the carrier, in this case AIG. They then forwarded the bill to their bill reviewer, in this case Coventry, who then adjudicated or reviewed the bill to determine which reductions, if any, would be applied to the bill. In this particular case, Coventry, based on an established hierarchy, determined or referred it to Aetna, who determined that an Aetna PPO contract governed the workers' compensation charges. That information was communicated from Aetna to Coventry, and Coventry communicated that information to AIG, my client in this case, that then issued payment along with an explanation of review or benefits that went to the provider along with payment explaining why they had not been paid their full bill charge. Through the course of litigation, the provider argued that they had certain contractual rights and obligations with Aetna that required certain notice of inclusion into a workers' comp network. That issue has been adjudicated and appealed, and this court determined in the Mueller-Martini case that the defendants in that case failed to satisfy their burden of establishing through the contractual requirements that the provider had been properly enrolled in AWCA. There was not a finding on the merits that Aetna did not properly enroll them, but rather that those involved in that case had failed to satisfy their burden. And I think that that's important, but I also think that it's important when you overlay this case and we talk about waiver, we need to keep in mind the timeline. When this case was first filed in 2011, the standard was, or at least a tribunal had looked at it and said initially that the AWCA reductions were proper. And that's the deputy commissioner. On appeal to the full commission also determined that these types of Aetna reductions were appropriate. It was only until that issue was heard in the Mueller-Martini court that there was some indication to my client for the first time that there may have been a problem with the Aetna network reductions. Prior to that time, my client had no knowledge that there were issues with the Aetna network reductions. And frankly, how would they? They weren't a party to the Aetna contract with the provider, and they had no knowledge at the time, in real time, that Coventry had ranked certain PPOs in their network. At the time, they didn't realize that the provider had entered into multiple overlapping PPO contracts that had been set into a hierarchy in the Coventry system. And that makes sense, even on a managed care side, for providers to enter into various contracts. They, generally speaking, don't enter into just one agreement. And it's also important to know that these overlapping contracts are not workers' compensation only contracts. Some of these, like the Aetna contract, are for managed care situations and potentially workers' comp situations. The reason that all of that is important is it really gets down to the heart of the medical provider's appeal about whether or not AIG waived or Coventry waived the rights to re-review the bill, remove the Aetna network reductions, and apply the next level in the Coventry hierarchy. Now, waiver is a factual issue, and the Commission's opinion is subject to the highest deferential credible evidence standard of review. And that's important because when looking at the context of the complicated litigation and appellate history, for several cases, the medical provider has held the defendants in those cases to that extremely high burden of showing waiver. And history and the case law will show that there have been efforts by various defendants, employers, claim administrators to say that certain levels of course of dealings, or in one case, the Rest and Surgery Center versus the City of Alexandria, that 600 EOBs should be considered evidence of waiver or notice. And in each one of those cases, this court had looked at it and said, waiver is a difficult burden and that it has to be established with clear, precise, and unequivocal evidence. And the Commission looked at that, and in light of the standards, and even referenced the complicated prior case law and said, there's no evidence of waiver. Now, what the medical provider has argued, essentially, is that there is some sort of implied waiver. But what they point to is twofold. They point to a hierarchy as evidence of some sort of implied waiver, and then they look to EORs as some sort of implied waiver. And I'm going to take each of those in turn. Now, when we look at the hierarchy, we need to keep in mind that waiver is an intentional relinquishment of a known right. The act of creating the hierarchy actually indicates that Coventry was not relinquishing any rights. They were specifically placing in a hierarchy the various contracts. Now, relinquishing those rights would be to either terminate those contracts or let them fall by the wayside, but the purpose of the hierarchy was really to establish consistency. Now, the medical provider will argue, or will likely argue, that the purpose of the hierarchy is to establish the greatest discounts as the primary contract. And the only evidence on that point is through Maureen Sample that said that the hierarchy is not established based on the lowest possible contract rate available, but rather it's coverage. And at the time that the hierarchy was established, the Aetna coverage had a broader geographic area. That's why it was listed as primary. Now, at the very least, the creation of the hierarchy is the evidence is evidence of a lack of intent to relinquish rights. The hierarchy implies a reservation of rights of those underlying contracts. The other issue is the real-time EORs and whether or not that evidences any sort of intentional relinquishment or waiver. It's important to remember that the EORs were generated and mailed by AIG. So we need to keep in mind that the medical provider's argument is essentially that an act of a third party, not a party to the contract, can act as a waiver to a contracting party's rights. And there's nothing in established case law or statutory construction that would allow that sort of using an act of AIG to hold Coventry to a standard. Now, the purpose of the explanations of review are very simple. They're to explain in real time why the provider is getting paid less than their bill charges. And in real time, when the contested bills were adjudicated or bill reviewed, the EORs referenced a net and network reduction. After multiple appeals on factually similar cases, in this particular case, AIG elected to remove the AWCA reductions and to reprocess the bills based on the existing hierarchy, which resulted in additional payments in 2014 being issued to the medical provider. Now, the medical provider makes a big deal about the time frame, but it's important to understand that in 2011, as evidenced by an affidavit that is signed by a representative for AWCA, they were attesting that those reductions were proper. And when that issue first became brought to the attention of the commission, they agreed that the AWCA reductions were proper. And the full commission, when they reviewed it, said those reductions are proper. So it wasn't until 2013 and into 2014 where that became an issue. So the timeline in regards to when that decision was made is relatively short, and that there really should not be any sort of penalty for that sort of delay, because it speaks to knowledge. There was no knowledge on the part of AIG that there were any perceived issues with Aetna until the litigation and the appeals had run their course. Now, and again, I think that it's important when we're talking about timeliness is that the provider did not object to these reductions for years. The payments that were issued were in 2008, and the only evidence on point that's in the record is from Maureen Sample that said that there was no indication that the medical provider was disputing the Aetna network reductions until they started filing claims in 2011. So again, it's important to understand the context of this particular case. Now, when it comes to citing specific authority, in prior cases and similar cases that have gone up, the medical provider has always held the payer defendant to a strong standard of establishing waiver. In this particular case, they're pivoting. They're pivoting to the Stockbridge case and an implied waiver scenario. And I think that the Stockbridge case can be distinguished. Primarily, in that particular case, there was a fiduciary duty between the litigants, and that's important. Now, in that case, in the Stockbridge case, the company asserted defenses to payment based on contractual provisions. We're not defending against payments under the First Health and Southern Health agreements, and we're not attempting to avoid any financial obligations under the contracts, as was the case in the Stockbridge case. We're actually using the First Health Agreement and the Southern Health Agreement as an entitlement, as a right. And I think that that sets the framework. One, you've got a fiduciary duty, but two, we're actually seeking to enforce the terms or the entitlements under the contract. The corporate context is also really important when evaluating whether or not Stockbridge applies to the facts in this particular case. In Stockbridge, you're talking about corporate directors that have fiduciary obligations and they're acquainted with the business and they have constructive knowledge. Again, our fact pattern is a little different and falls outside of that framework because as it relates to the Aetna contract, Coventry wasn't a party. AIG wasn't a party. So we have no knowledge of those terms. And it's difficult to imply a waiver when you have we're the one entity that had no idea what was involved in that particular contract. Now, and for the reasons stated in our brief, we believe that the full commission was correct that the medical provider failed to establish that Coventry had waived any rights to the First Health and Southern Health agreements. I think it's also important that there's no real reasonable argument that AIG could not access the First Health and Southern Health Agreement. So I'm not going to spend too much time really arguing that, but I do think that it's important to point out that in this case, we're really talking about two separate cases. The first part of the case deals with the first aid of service, and the controlling contracts in that are the network service agreement between AIG and First Health and the First Health agreement with Dr. Coleman. In the second kind of independent section of the case, or subpart of the case, is a managed care service agreement between AIG and Coventry and a Southern Health agreement with the group. And so there's no real argument that we did not have access. We clearly had access. We were named parties in both of those service agreements. And clearly the provider signed a contract that they wanted to be added to the particular networks at issue. So really focusing on the reimbursement. So as it relates to the First Health agreement, the medical provider has, and I see that I'm going into my rebuttal, so I'm going to reserve my time unless there are any pressing.
All right. You have your rebuttal. Thank you. Mrs. Spivey.
Judge Chafin, Judge Beals, Judge Baumgartner, I'm Ed Spivey, and it's my privilege today to represent the appellant, the cross-appellant and appellee, Orthopedic and Spine Center, before you. I did reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. All we've heard about from the appellant is our appeal. We haven't heard anything about the appellant's appeal, so instead of reserving five, reserve 10 minutes. I'm not sure if the court's going to permit Ms. Alcorn in her remaining 5 minutes to address her appeal at all, in that she hasn't addressed it yet.
Well, it is her time, so I think we will allow her to use that as she sees fit. But if you want to reserve 10.
I think I'll shift and right. Then reserve 10. Thank you, okay. Judge Beals. So let me focus then on our appeal, which does arise from the first holding of the Workers' Comp Commission, namely the reversal of the holding by Deputy Commissioner Wilder, who had held that the, I'll call them the employer carriers here, collectively, had waived their ability to fall back on alternative PPO contracts, namely this First Health contract and the Southern Health contract. That ruling by Deputy Commissioner Wilder, reviewing the exact same documentary record that is before this tribunal, was then the subject of a split opinion at the Workers' Comp Commission level. Commissioner Marshall authored a 6-page dissent in which he explained his grounds for agreeing with the ruling below by Deputy Commissioner Wilder and disagreeing with the two-commissioner majority. That is the decision that we have appealed. The basic facts are clear and not in dispute. The services in this case, the medical services rendered to injured worker Manuel Garcia, were rendered back in 2008, not in 2011. That is the date that Ms. Alcorn has focused on you with on with you in her comments. That is the date, the year during which certain of these claims began percolating up. But I think it's important that the key date is the date the services were rendered in 2008 and the date that those services were paid for by the employer carriers, which also happened in 2008. One date of service was December 2008, so the payment for that one occurred in very early 2009.
I don't know if it has anything to do with it, but I just have to ask the question, why was there a 3-year delay in disputing the payment? What happened? This is the practical matter.
Judge Baumgartner, I think perhaps you got some flavor of that when Ms. Alcorn attempted to explain the levels of entity that exist out there on the other side of the payment equation. From Orthopedic and Spine's perspective, it's relatively simple. You treat a patient, you send an invoice to either an employer or a workers' compensation insurance carrier who is identified by that employer, and then someday thereafter, payment is received. The fact that there is a Coventry Healthcare back
no,
behind
just,
that curve.
Just a simple question. Is you've been a small time operation one time. It seems that you got paid, and it was 3 years later that you found out you didn't get paid enough.
That's
why 3 years before you found out that you didn't think you got the right treatment under your contractual rights?
Because
that'll be a simple answer to it.
Because orthopedic and spine is treating literally hundreds of patients, some small fraction of which are workers' compensation patients. And quite honestly, that level of diligence is applied to match payments to patients. But whether or not there's a workers' compensation carrier on the other end of that payment, whether or not that workers' compensation carrier has separately contracted with some managed care company to review or adjust or discount those bills is not information that was discerned by Orthopedic and Spine Center's back office until a few years down the road. And it was not until the onion began being peeled back in the various layers of adjustment.
Well, what caused somebody to decide 3 years after they had, I presume, cashed the check, that they didn't get paid right?
Well, here's what caused it.
What caused the back office to finally, despite the fact they're that busy, to find out whether they've gotten paid properly?
They began to see that these explanations of benefit recite an Aetna Workers' Compensation Access program that they were supposedly being discounted pursuant to. And the back office said, well, that's strange. We are not contracted with anything called Aetna Workers' Compensation Access. Now, this was the subject of the Mueller-Martini decision by this court. We Orthopedic and Spine Center, were contracted with an entity, an Aetna entity for commercial patients, but we hadn't contracted with Aetna to discount services rendered to workers' compensation patients. Workers' compensation patients are subject to the...
Okay, I'm taking too much of your time with that question.
But that's very important, Judge Baumgartner. I'm glad you asked, because that's precisely when the light bulb went off. And it was only then, and the investigation that ensued, whereby Orthopedic and Spine found, hey, our bills are being discounted pursuant to a program that we're not a member of. We litigated that. The decision in Mueller-Martini came down. This court ruled that, no, indeed, you aren't a member of that program. These payors had no right to discount your bills pursuant to that program. And we thought that should have been enough. But no, that's what brings us here today. Instead, the payor, and the payor in this case, fell back on alternative contracts that had never been mentioned before. They were not mentioned back in 2008 and early 2009 when these explanations of benefits were rendered. There was absolutely no mention of First Health or Southern Health, which are the contracts that the payor is now, are now, the payor is now using to attempt to justify an alternative discount. And we believe that Deputy Commissioner Wilder and Commissioner Marshall were correct in concluding that because the payors, who undoubtedly and irrefutably knew that they had alternative contracts that they were going to endeavor to rely on back in 2008, because they did not say one word about those contracts, because that they did not do what insurance carriers are very adept at doing, which is reserving their rights for all manner of potential contractual defenses. Because they didn't do either of those things, they waived those contractual defenses. And we believe that the decision in Stockbridge versus Gemini is on all fours. It is a decision by the Virginia Supreme Court in which implied waiver was found as a matter of law, based on the documentary record in that case, under almost identical circumstances. Now, we thought it was strange that in the briefing there was no mention by the payors of that case. We cited that case in our opening appeal brief, and it was not combated at all in their brief. Now, Ms. Alcorn did attempt to combat it in her comments before you this morning. And what she said is that somehow the payors here are attempting to use the contract differently. They're attempting to use the First Health and Southern Health contracts affirmatively, whereas, according to Ms. Alcorn, they were not so used in Stockbridge. And I believe that's incorrect. What we have in both cases is a party attempting to use a contract as a defense. In Stockbridge, it was a defense to paying for stock. In this case, it's a defense to paying what's owed for medical services rendered. And just as that defense was waived in Stockbridge because it was never mentioned, it has been waived here. Indeed, the time period is multiples of the time period that was enough in Stockbridge to cause the Virginia Supreme Court to conclude that waiver existed. We simply don't think there's any margin between this situation and that addressed in Stockbridge, and consequently, it should govern the court in this case on the waiver issue. I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steiger.
Now, on brief and in argument, the provider tends to consolidate AIG with Coventry, with Aetna. And I think that that's improper because AIG has no knowledge of contractual rights or obligation that the provider has entered into, other than payment recommendations that it receives from Coventry. It's important to keep these entities separate as it relates to the ultimate element of waiver that's missing is knowledge. It has to be an intentional relinquishment of a right with knowledge of the facts. And it's important to remember that there are distinctions between AIG and Coventry. They're independent corporate entities. And so the fact that AIG is mailing an EOR to the medical provider should not be any sort of evidence attributed to Coventry related to a waiver. For multiple reasons. The purpose of an EOR is not to provide notice or to provide, and we know that. We know that it's not intended to be noticed because that issue has been litigated in the Mueller Martini and the Reston Surgery Center case and the Keystone case. We know definitively that EORs are not notice. We also know that EORs are not evidence of waiver because the elements of waiver need to be attributed to both parties equally. And if EORs are insufficient in evidence of waiver in the context of a payer defending a claim, then an EOR in this case is insufficient. And what the medical provider is looking at is the one EOR that went with payment in 2008. And there is a reference to the Aetna network reductions, but there's a second EOR that goes. As soon as the Aetna reductions are removed, a new EOR is generated by AIG that indicates that the payment had been issued based on a Coventry-owned contract. So we have two EORs for each payment that goes out or for each date of service. Now, moving or pivoting a little bit in regards to the ambiguity issue that's been alleged, I think that it's important when we're looking at the context of the contract to actually look at the applicable or governing reimbursement. And in this particular case, the medical provider, and let me just make a caveat, under the First Health Agreement, there's no argument related to the payment calculus. There is an argument as to ambiguity of the Southern Health Agreement. And so in the Southern Health Agreement, it's important to note that the provider contracted with Southern Health for two essential types of participation, in a network lease arrangement and a workers' comp arrangement. And in both of those arrangements, the contractual rate is essentially the same, which is you're either going to be paid your usual charge or the contracted rate. And the contracted rate can be found in an attachment. And for workers' compensation, that attachment is A2. And the plain reading, there's no ambiguity on the face of that reimbursement provision. It allows for essentially three methods of reimbursement: subpart A1, or subpart A2, or subpart B. And in this case, the only evidence that was presented at the trial level was that reimbursement was issued pursuant to subpart A1. There wasn't any evidence at all presented as to what the other reimbursement would have been under the other two alternative mechanisms. Now, the provider is arguing that A2 attachment is ambiguous. And I think it's important to remember that ambiguity isn't based on, is it confusing? Because I think, to be fair, when you look at that A2 reimbursement, for someone that is not in the industry, that's either not a medical provider or a payer, it is less than ideal. But being less than ideal does not rise to the level of an ambiguity. First off, as it relates to the reimbursement, again, the only evidence in the record is that payment was issued pursuant to subsection A1. There was absolutely no evidence of a breach. There was no evidence of what the prevailing community rate would be. And more importantly, whether or not you accept the provider's argument that subsection B is either the prevailing community rate or what have you, that issue isn't, I don't think we really need to be, I think that's a distraction. We don't need to be focused on that, because the only evidence in the record is that payment was made at a contracted rate that the provider agreed to. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Elkin.
One or two last words on the payor's comments regarding our appeal, and then I'll pivot to their appeal. The AIG is the party who waived. AIG sent the EOB. The fact that AIG separately contracted with Coventry is important, and Coventry's knowledge, actions, et cetera, are imputed to AIG because AIG relied upon them. But to the extent Ms. Alcorn was arguing that this is a waiver, that we have to show waiver by AIG, by Coventry, it really sort of misses the mark, because the explanations of benefit, which are important documents, they are documents that are dealt with both in the preferred provider agreement with Orthopedic and Spine Center and in the separate contracts between AIG and Coventry. They are held up as documents that have to be accurate. And they are also tied to a fundamental contract right of payment within 30 to 40 days. That is spelled out in those contracts, and consequently, when that explanation of benefits gets it wrong, it has consequences from a waiver perspective. And this is all dealt with, obviously, more specifically in the brief, but it is to the extent that Ms. Alcorn is arguing that AIG waived, but Coventry didn't waive. Well, AIG is the party we're concerned with here. The fact that they relied on Coventry is their business. Let me now talk about the alternate appeal that the payors have brought, which is grounded upon the contractual calculus that is applicable under this alternative fallback Southern Health agreement. This court doesn't even get to these issues if the ruling is that there was a waiver by virtue of the failure to mention this alternative contract in the explanations of benefit. But if the court does reach it, there are first and foremost several contractual principles that are at issue. And frankly, both parties have embraced these in their briefs. It's fundamental tenets of Virginia law. The contract itself, the words used are the guiding light when interpreting the contract. Contracts are to be construed in a way to avoid absurd results. They are to be construed in a way that avoids indefiniteness. They're to be construed in a way that avoids language of doubtful import or that can be understood in more than one way. And where you have contractual language that is of doubtful import or that can be understood in more than one way, you have ambiguity. And that is what both the deputy commissioner and the full commission, all three members, concluded below you have with regard to this Southern Health contract, and for good reason. The construction proffered by the employer carriers of this Southern Health contract is fundamentally at odds with all of those contractual principles I referenced. They contend that this contract was somehow intentionally drafted to allow for a jump ball kind of result, an or that leads to no definite guidance contractually on what the proper payment can be. They contend that they, the payors, again, AIG advised by Coventry, had absolute discretion to pay Orthopedic and Spine Center whatever they decided to pay them. And that, I submit, is fundamental. It violates all of those contract principles. And most importantly, it violates what the actual language of the contract says. The key provision in the Southern Health Agreement with regard to payment says that physician, Orthopedic and Spine Center, agrees to accept as payment in full the lesser of physician's usual charge or the amount allowable for covered services under the applicable fee schedule in effect. In order for the payor's construction of this contract to even be possible, forget about all the common sense reasons why a contract leading to a jump ball result just doesn't make sense. Aside from those, it violates that provision of the contract. It would have had to say amounts, because what the payors are arguing is that the contract can legitimately lead to not just one amount, but to different amounts, and that it's at their discretion to decide which of those amounts it wants to pay. So we believe that the tribunals below were absolutely on firm ground in concluding that this contract is ambiguous. We believe that the tribunals below were absolutely on sound ground in concluding that once the contract is ambiguous, it is under well-accepted rules of construction under Virginia law, construed against the drafter, and therefore the alternative reading that they wish to supply the court is not valid, and instead the reading that Orthopedic and Spine has proffered is the valid one. Now, on that point, I think what the payors here are fundamentally saying is that the court is misconstruing this, the tribunals below were misconstruing this court's opinion in Leibovitz from several years ago. And we believe that that is a misconstruction of Leibovitz. It attempts to read into Leibovitz things that were not at all held to be the case in that case, and that in construing the statute in this case and the holding in Leibovitz, both the full commission and the deputy commissioner were absolutely right. One thing Leibovitz does show is that there was a way for Coventry or AIG or AIG acting through Coventry to have avoided this problem. They could have used the same contractual language that was construed in Leibovic and ruled on by the Court of Appeals in Leibovic. They could have used that very language in this agreement. And in fact, there's a very incestuous relationship amongst all these companies that you read about, First Health, Southern Health, Coventry. They are now all one, so it was undoubtedly available to them, but they chose not to. They used different language, fundamentally different language, that both tribunals below correctly concluded took it outside of the decision in Leibovic, and it is thus even more validly the case that the contract that's before you, the Southern Health contract, can and should be considered on its own. And when compared to the contract at issue in Leibovic, it simply isn't the same. One other thing that Leibovic says that's important, and that is a rule that this tribunal is clearly very familiar with. The Leibovic court cited to Kozar in saying that as a general rule, the construction afforded a statute by the public officials charged with its administration and enforcement is entitled to be given weight by the court. Judge Beals, I think you, a panel you sat on, reiterated that more recently in the Vico construction case. Here, to do what the payors are urging the court to do would require you to reject the construction of the Virginia statute as informed by this contract, to do what Orthopedic and Spine asks you to do, which is to affirm the opinion below, asks you to embrace that interpretation because it's the correct one. I'll take any, in the few seconds I have remaining, any questions the court has, but otherwise, thank you for your attention.
Mm-hmm. Any questions for Mr. Spivey? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Spivey. We will recounsel. Then the next case on our docket is Chris Durant.